Dr. Kwaczynski is originally from Montreal, and he came to the United States at age 2. So I'm curious to see if he considers himself an American or a Canadian. We can get to that later. He attended UCLA for his bachelor's and medical degrees, and then he did his residency in internal medicine and his fellowship in hematology at the University of Washington. He then took a faculty position there, and he ascended the ranks at University of Washington to professor and section chief of hematology. And he stayed there until 2002, at which time he was appointed the chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSD in San Diego. And he's been at Stony Brook now since 2010, and he currently holds the post of Dean of the School of Medicine, and he's also the Senior Vice President of Health Science. Dr. Kwaczynski has had a very successful research career. He's had over 200 peer-reviewed publications. He's currently has an R01 grant that is in its 20th year of funding. He's done some groundbreaking work in the field of hematology, and his lab has been involved with a lot of things. It's focused on hematopoietic growth factors, and his lab has actually cloned a number of genes, including that for thrombopoietin. And he's worn many hats over the years, both leadership and administrative, in addition to his research and clinical duties. He served as the editor-in-chief of the journal Blood, and he is a member of the American Society of Clinical Investigation, and he served as the president of that organization, and that's a special organization for APSA because we hold our annual meeting with the American Society for Clinical Investigation and have for the past number of years. And he's also a member of the American Association of Physicians and also the prestigious National Academy of Sciences. And I should just say he is married with 2 kids, and his daughter, he must not have turned his family off to research too much because his daughter is a molecular biologist, and his son is an economist in Boston. So with that, thank you for joining us, Dr. Kwaczynski. And I'm just going to go ahead and ask you a quick question to get things started, if you don't mind. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
All right. So if you wouldn't mind describing some of the kind of the important crossroads or maybe epiphany moments in your career that kind of led your career in the direction that it's gone and to where you are today.
So many such moments. I appreciate the question. I actually appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you this evening. I do have a special place in my heart for APSA, for physician scientists of all ilk. It sounded like most of the people on the call are MD, PhD, are in MD, PhD programs. I actually, as Peter described, I'm what's called a late bloomer. I decided I wanted to pursue a scientific career after I had done all of my undergraduate and medical school and then clinical training. And just as a quick aside, there are probably 3 or 4 times as many physician scientists who are late bloomers like me than are individuals like yourselves who went through an organized MD-PhD program. But back to the question, which is what were the sort of moments in career decision-making? One interesting career decision-making moment came when I was an undergraduate, and I was a senior, and I took a course in biomedical research literature. I had a very dynamic professor. This was at UCLA, and I really, that was the first moment that I truly appreciated how intricate biomedical research can be, how critical interpretive skills are for a successful career as a biomedical researcher. And I really enjoyed biochemistry, and that was sort of what launched my interest in pursuing a more scientific career in medicine. So I was a medical student, as it was described, at UCLA. And after 8 years at UCLA as an undergraduate and a medical student, my wife and I decided if we're ever going to leave Los Angeles, we had better leave then to do an internal medicine residency. And so we packed up and went to the University of Washington in Seattle, where I came across some very instrumental mentors, specifically 3 critical mentors during my career. And mentorship is the critical element, I think, that is so important for creating a meaningful career. So the first mentor I came across was a fellow by the name of Clem Finch. Clem was the chief of hematology at the University of Washington at the time. And as I was beginning to think about what kind of specialty I wanted to go into, I went and spoke to the division chiefs at the University of Washington, who were the heads of the divisions I was interested in. I'll admit to all of you that I didn't say, oh, I want to be a hematologist. First off, I sort of did it backwards. I decided first what I didn't want to do. I decided, you know, I didn't want to be a gastroenterologist. That was for certain. And so I spoke with the various people, the head of nephrology, the head of pulmonary, and the head of hematology. And Clem convinced me that a career in hematology was very rewarding because, as Clem put it, we understood our diseases at the atomic and biochemical level better than most other disciplines. And so I was hooked. I then met my main mentor, if you will, John Adamson, who succeeded Clem as head of the Division of Hematology. And John really showed me the power of hematology research, what you could really do by investigating these cells that are so easy to obtain from the blood or from the bone marrow. And that's what really launched my interest in hematological research. And then finally, I met up with a fellow by the name of Earl Davey, who was the chair of biochemistry at the University of Washington. For those of you who have gone through biochemistry of blood clotting, you'll remember that famous waterfall cascade. That's all Earl. Earl has cloned or characterized probably half of all the blood coagulation factors. He's the one who came up with that waterfall cascade that ultimately leads to thrombin generation. And Earl taught me biochemistry, and that was bringing together a basic science skill of biochemistry, of purifying proteins, and John suggesting that there was a great deal of interest in identifying the hormones and cytokines that stimulate blood cell production. So it was the combined efforts of those three individuals, Clem and John and Earl, that really was a major impact on the pathway that I chose for my career to be a, you know, a physician scientist studying how blood cells are produced. So one early on epiphany, if you will. Another major turning point came when I read a paper in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And we had already cloned several growth factors in the laboratory at that time, GM, CSF, and interleukin-3. But I read a paper in the PNAS. It was in the virology section. And normally I don't read much virology, just to be honest about it. But this paper tickled my interest because it described a proto-oncogene that, based on my work in GM-CSF and interleukin-3 and other cytokines and erythropoietin, I quickly recognized that this proto-oncogene looked every bit like a blood growth factor receptor. There was certain homology with the erythropoietin receptor and the GM-CSF receptor and the IL-3 receptor. And based on where that proto-oncogene was cloned, from a human erythroleukemia cell line, based on the fact that it was grown out of a cell line, it was cloned out of a cell line that I knew could either become red cell-like or could become megakaryocyte-like, I took a guess that this was the mythical thrombopoietin receptor. And so I went to work with some colleagues trying to use that proto-oncogene receptor to identify thrombopoietin, and about 2 years later we were able to clone thrombopoietin. So that was the sort of scientific epiphanies. Mentorship heading me in the direction of biochemistry in hematology, and then a high-risk approach to finding this new growth factor. So that's the story in rather simplistic form. Couple of epiphanies.
Great. Sounds like a fun story and career. At this time, let's go ahead and open up the floor to questions. Since we're a fairly small group, we can go ahead and ask questions. If you want to unmute your microphone, anybody can feel free to ask a question. Whether you're
second.
Go ahead.
Maybe I can get it rolling. You mentioned, I see this, we're obviously not mentoring on the same level that you are, but you mentioned mentoring is just a huge part of your training and successes, and have you seen a switch from being the mentee, the trained to the trainer, or the mentee to the mentor at some point of your career?
Yeah, it's a very interesting transition because, you know, a mentor's has about 6 or 8 different roles to play. In the 1990s, Hillary Clinton, before she became Secretary of State, when she was the First Lady, used the phrase, "It takes a village to raise a child," which is based on an old African saying. And of course, the religious right just blasted her out of the water. Oh, you're shirking your family responsibilities, blah, blah, blah. I really do believe that it takes a village to raise a biomedical scientist. Meaning, one mentor is probably not sufficient because there are these 6 or 8 roles. As I was being mentored, and just parenthetically, you should all know that I still think John is my mentor. Mentoring is lifelong and in both directions. And so I hope that all of the people that I mentored, which is probably 20 or 25 postdoctoral fellows and graduate students and the like, 20 or 25 people still consider me their mentor, even though many of them are professors and chairs of medicine, and I hesitate to say one is even going over to the dark side to becoming a dean fairly soon. So that transition period between being mentee and mentor is a gradual one, but I don't think it's as heady a pursuit as was implied by the question, because I think if you're going to be successful, it really does take a village, and there are going to be additional people around to help with all those other skills. You may be able to help with the laboratory research skills, but someone else might be giving the career advice, or someone else might be listening to what is really needed. So there's it takes a team. And so as you transition from being mentored to being the mentor, you're gradually acquiring those important skills of being a successful mentor.
Thank you.
We have any other questions?
I have a couple, but I don't want to steal the spotlight. If anyone else wants to go.
So I see we can get to your question in a second, Steve, but Giselle asked a question. Can you see it in the chat box, Dr. Koshansky? I'll just go ahead and ask, just so we can
hear. Yeah, I can see it. From your experience, what are the characteristics of a good mentored mentee? Is that the question?
Yeah, good mentor and mentee.
Oh, I see it's right on set. Okay, good mentor and mentee. So there are several critical things. It is, as the question implies, a bidirectional flow of information. The good mentee needs to listen well, needs to be open and share the concerns, the thoughts, And the good mentee, you know, look, it's hard work. You guys all know that pursuing a career as a physician scientist is not for the faint of heart. You know, as someone once said, you know, it's hard work. Sometimes you have to even work Saturdays. That's actually a famous quote that George Bush Jr. Was quoted as saying, talking about the presidency. It's hard work. Sometimes you have to work Saturdays. It is hard work. So the good mentee is going to be willing to, you know, roll up the sleeves and work hard, is going to, you know, openly dialogue with their mentor. They're going to be, you know, timely. They're not going to miss meetings and things like that. But most of the responsibility for the good relationship falls upon the mentor. There's a book that was published about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, you know, called The Vanishing Physician Scientist, or something like that. It was Andy Schaefer, who was chair of medicine at Cornell at the time, convened a number of people who were chairs of medicine to talk about the vanishing physician scientist, to talk about what it takes to patch up the leaky pipeline, if you will. And I was asked to write the chapter on mentoring the physician scientist. And you know, you need to be an advisor in the sense that you need to be looking out for the best interests of your mentee. If you believe that your mentee just doesn't have the skill set to pursue one particular line of career development, then you need to be honest and say that. You have to be a good educator. There are certain skill sets that the mentor usually has that the mentor needs to pass along to the trainee. You must have generosity. I think if I had to pick one word to describe the critical element of a good mentor, it's generosity. And by that I mean you need to be willing to give of your time, and you're really not expecting to get much back except the singular sense of satisfaction that you've helped somebody realize their potential, in this case, to be a great physician scientist. It does take time. You need to listen well. You need to hear what the mentee's concerns are and address them. And if you can't address them, you need to spend the time to find the person who can address those needs for the mentee. But generosity is really critical. Let me just give one example. When I was a department chair at UC San Diego, I had this young man, a physician scientist. He was an infectious disease researcher. He wasn't a hematologist. But he was having trouble with his mentor because his mentor, who had already published about 500 peer-reviewed papers, his mentor insisted that didn't matter what he did, because this young person was in the mentor's laboratory, the mentor had to be on every single paper he published. By this point, he's already a late assistant professor. He's coming up for the tenure decision. He's coming up for promotion. And yet, the tenure committee could not tell that he was an independent investigator, because virtually every peer-reviewed paper he had his mentor's name on it. Contrast that example. Contrast that example with my mentor, John Adamson. John was on my first four papers as an author. And then I don't think John was on another single paper after that, even though, as I mentioned earlier, to this day I consider John a mentor. He was continuing to help guide my scientific career long after that fourth paper was published. And so a good example of generosity, which I believe is so important to be a good mentor. You're welcome.
All right, other questions? You can go ahead, Steve, if you'd like.
Yeah, so I think in the grand scheme of everything, we're kind of at a really interesting time point in that the biomedical scientists and clinical researchers are needed more than they've ever been needed before. But on the flip side of that, we're facing the most hyper-competitive environment in science and medicine that we've ever really faced, I guess. And so that puts us at, we're kind of at the forefront of our careers. Where does it exactly, how do you think the future is going to be laid out for us being needed, but also faced with competition that hasn't ever been seen before? It makes me excited and nervous at the same time, and maybe some of your experiences might open up our eyes to what lays ahead of us.
So a great question, a question that I get on a fairly frequently. A couple of thoughts. First of all, science, the days where, you know, an individual is going to go into a laboratory and come up with a eureka discovery all by him or herself, I think those days are pretty much behind us. Biomedical science has become a team sport. And it's so critical for you guys to be successful to be part of a surrounding environment that's going to be nurturing, that's going to be helpful, that is going to give you the experiences and the collaborators and the colleagues that will help you become successful scientifically. So the days of trying to do it all by your lonesome and trying to, you know, duke it out with, you know, professors and people with Howard Hughes money and those kind of things. I don't think you shouldn't put yourself in that kind of an environment. You really ought to make sure that the environment that you're surrounded is going to have a very collegial nature to it. It's going to have generous people. It's going to have people with complementary research skills. Biomedical science has become so highly technical today. No one person can be expected to master all of the technologies that are needed to be successful. You really need to have colleagues to complement your skill set so that together you'll be able to ask and address the critical questions that interest you. If you don't have that sort of critical mass of people in your environment, it becomes that much more difficult. The other, you know, key element to keep in mind is that your sense that this is the most highly competitive time in biomedical science that there has ever been. I'm old. You guys are young. I have seen cycles in biomedical funding. My career has spanned at least three complete cycles of funding. And so there are going to be rich times and there are going to be lean times. And as you correctly surmise, we're in one of those lean times. But most of us believe that the lean times are going to give way to better times. I don't have my crystal ball handy, so I can't tell you whether that's going to be in a week or a month or a year or 3 years, but biomedical research support really is cyclical. And there's a couple of structural flaws in the system that creates that, but nevertheless, it is what it is, and we've seen lots of cycles. The other thing is that you're reading all these editorials that say that this is, you know, you'll never get a grant until you're 50 years old, and that a physician scientist is neither, you know, and the editorialists who are writing those, you know, death and dire predictions about biomedical sciences, I'm not saying that they're, you know, telling all sorts of lies up one side and down the other, but they clearly have an agenda, and their agenda, of course, is to free up more money for biomedical research. And so very often these editorials are a little bit more pessimistic than they really ought to be. And so I would argue, and I sit on one of the NIH councils. I'm on the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Disease Council. And so every 3 or 4 months I go to Bethesda and sit down with all these nephrologists and all these gastroenterologists. I'm sort of the token hematologist there, although the director of the institute is a hematologist, I might add. But we talk about, you know, the future of funding and what kind of topics are being funded, and most of the NIH institutes really bend over backwards to help young people. They bend over backwards to help, you know, people who are well trained. They bend over backwards to help people who are doing the kind of, are in the kind of environment that they like to see successful people come from. So I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I also don't want you to get too depressed by all the editorials out there saying that, you know, it'll be 50 years old till you get your first grant. Peter mentioned a daughter. You know, I do have a daughter. We have a daughter. Daughter is a scientist. I'm fond of saying that, or she's actually fond of saying that she had no choice but to go into science because at age 4 I had her in the laboratory labeling Eppendorf tubes. So she really had no option except to go into science. And daughter just got her K99 ROO award, and she's actually written a successful RO1 award. And so young people do have a role in science, so I would just advise stick with it. Make sure you're in that kind of nurturing microenvironment, and just go for it because it is a very fun career pathway. I see that Andrew wrote a question about the balance between research time, teaching, clinical administration. And I think I'll take that one on. You know, it gets at the sort of the four-legged stool, if you will, of academic medicine. And the answer is, to Andrew, you can do it all. You just can't do it all at one time. And at different phases of your career, you can be a terrific clinician. At different phases of your career, you can be a terrific teacher. At other times, you really need to devote 80-90% of your time to your research career. And then when you get old like me, you can become a department chair or an evil dean, sort of work to create that microenvironment, to create that environment for the great clinicians and the great teachers and the great researchers to pursue their interests. So you can't do it all at once. You know, you have to focus during different phases of your career, but over a career, in fact, you can do the research and the teaching and the clinical and even the administrative.
Thank you, sir. That's exciting to hear about your daughter.
And you're welcome.
I'm sure that's you're very proud of your daughter and that she's followed in your footsteps. That's exciting. So, any other?
Well, no. I just have to interrupt. See, yeah. She would have a fit if she heard anybody say that she followed in my footsteps. You see, Dad, what you do is just too applied. So daughter, you know, it is kind of fun. We've actually published, I think, 4 papers together. This sprung out of her PhD thesis. When she was doing her thesis, she was getting a systems biology thesis up at a little Crimson School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I learned of what her thesis advisor did, and I thought to myself, hey, we could use some of that in our lab. So we hammered out a really cool collaboration after about an hour and a half on the phone. And then the very next morning, a daughter calls me up and she says, Dad, we have to talk about authorship. And I just broke out laughing. Nevertheless, we have now penned 4 papers together. So as her scientific career zooms upward, mine spirals downward. But that's the different phase of my career.
That's great. So any other questions? All right. Well, other people are thinking, I'm going to go ahead and ask another one, sir. So I'm always curious for people who have been there and done that, who've had a long, successful career. I always like to ask, so if you could do something differently, maybe something you've learned from your mistakes, perhaps, or going down the wrong direction in certain areas, what do you think it would be if you could go back and redo something?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I don't know that there were, you know, so many missteps that I would sort of completely redo a couple of things. I think early on when I was a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory, I probably should have pursued my PhD. I probably could have used the coursework, although, you know, things worked out okay scientifically. I think that the rigor might have been helpful for my early scientific career. As we were working, as I was doing my research in my postdoctoral fellowship, Earl Davey, whose lab I was in, asked me at one point, should I do the coursework that I would need for the PhD, and I elected not to, but that was a minor thing. I really don't know of any major goofs other than, you know, obviously experiments that didn't work. You know, as you folks know, the people who are in the lab now know, you know, if you're getting 30 or 40% of your experiments to work, you're doing great. And so I wouldn't, you know, chalk up all those 60% or 70% failed experiments to a major problem at, you know, but, good question. What would I have done? I don't know that I would have done that much differently, but, you know, maybe moved from the University of Washington a little bit earlier. Probably not. I thought that was a great, great experience at the University of Washington. Nope. Don't have any major regrets. Sorry.
Do you think it's a good idea to move somewhere, whether it's from transitioning from undergrad to medical school or from an MD PhD program to a residency or postdoc and then to your first academic appointment? What's your view on that?
A couple of thoughts. A great question and a question that a lot of people face. There are, first of all, just in medicine. So just as was mentioned, as Peter mentioned early on, I'm an internal medicine doc. I'm a hematologist. And as you will learn, there is no one right way to do something in medicine. There's 100 wrong ways to do something in medicine, but there's not just one or two right ways. And as a consequence, you know, in any given university, medical center or whatever, they're probably going to do, you know, you're going to take care of heart failure patients the same way. So that if you want to see the two or three right ways to do something, you do need to have experienced more than a single institution. And then by seeing the two or three right ways to do something in clinical medicine, you can then choose for your own career which for you is the right way to take care of heart failure or take care of anemia or take care of leukemia. And I think that applies also for science. It is of some benefit to surround yourself with a couple of different environments. The approach, the collaborators you develop can sometimes complement one another. Moving is hard. There is no question about it. When you move, you're starting over. You got to make sure the lab starts working again. You have to hire new technicians or, you know, recruit new graduate students or postdocs. Moving during your career development is challenging. And I suppose to some extent it will depend on your mentoring environment where you do the majority of your training. If you have the kind of mentor, as I described for that young man who was one of my faculty members, whose mentor already had 500 papers on his CV and didn't need 502 or 503 at the expense of this young man, if that's your environment, you really ought to move. And that young man ended up moving to a new university. So if that's the kind of environment and you want to establish your independence, you do need to move. I never felt like I had to move. I moved twice in my career. I moved from the University of Washington to UC San Diego, but that was because I wanted to become a department chair. And then again, I moved from UC San Diego to Stony Brook because I wanted to become a dean of a medical school. And just as an aside, there are I have this theory about academic medicine that it's a genetic disorder, that it's autosomal recessive, that is, you need at least two mutant alleles. And that the phenotype that goes with that genotype is that you never feel comfortable when you're on the flat part of the learning curve. If you have both mutant alleles, you only feel comfortable when you're on the steep part of the learning curve. And that was really the primary motivating reason for my two moves in my career, is that although the research was going really well at the University of Washington, I felt like personally I was on the flat part of the learning curve and wanted to cast a bit of a broader net in internal medicine by becoming a chair of a department of internal medicine at a research-intense university. And then I felt after 8.5 years as a chair of medicine, again, my learning curve was flattening out and wanted to explore the world of being a dean and making an impact on medical students and on MD-PhD students, because we have an MD-PhD program at Stony Brook, recruiting terrific new department chairs and new deans. And so all of that has been to sort of make the bigger impact. But there's pros and cons to moving or staying put. You learn a little bit more when you move because you experience additional environments. You will usually get a better startup package to launch your career if you move than if you stay put. But developing collaborators takes time. Developing a good team of team members in your laboratory takes time. And if you have a good environment at your existing institution, one where you are going to be given full credit for your independent work, and that your career is not going to be overshadowed by that of your mentor or others, because people just don't believe that that work was yours. It must have been your mentor. If you believe that you will be given the credit due you, then there is often no good reason to move and then recreate what you've already established at your home institution.
Great. Thank you for the very thorough answer. So any other questions? I'd be interested in hearing some questions. I know we have some young folks on this call. Any questions from undergraduates or from anybody else?
I'll just limit this to my last question because I know I'm taking a bit of time, but I think for a lot of us, we're obviously quite junior in our career, and as we go through our graduate training, the predicament, whether you should have maybe a fewer number of high-impact publications or a larger quantity of, if you will, lower-impact publications early in the career, we're having a debate at our own institution about the importance of the high-impact lower quantity versus the low-impact higher quantity of publications. Do you have maybe any insight into this, or what your thoughts on this might be? I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, I actually have a fair number of thoughts. When I was a department chair in San Diego, I had a very, very bright young geneticist. He had trained at a very, very top-notch laboratory in the Northeast. He had set up shop at UC San Diego. Very, very bright person studying the genetics of some neurological disorders. And he was taught by his mentor that it's just not worth publishing anything unless it's the complete story and unless it's in Cell Science or Nature. I mean, don't even bother with anything else. At UC San Diego, we had a 7-year up or out clock. And if you aren't promoted and given tenure by your 7th year, you were given a terminal appointment and you were looking for a job. And this young man, did not take my advice. He only insisted on, the complete story in Cell Science or Nature. And he almost lost his job. So that was, one extreme, of the singular high impact paper. Now, nobody wants their career characterized by a bunch of little biddly things that are in journals with an impact factor of 1.23. Nobody, wants to say, oh yeah, that was the 4th time that was proven. And so my advice in this regard is that you want to be working on two things simultaneously. And I apologize in advance for the baseball metaphors here, but you want to be working on a project that is going to be a solid single, but you also want to be working on a project that could be a home run, knowing that those home run projects give you a very strong likelihood of striking out, but because you're going to have a higher batting average with singles than you are hitting home runs. So if you can craft two kinds of projects that you are working on, a project that logically goes from point A to point B, and then it asks the follow-up question, which will get you to point C, and then you'll get you to point D, you know that those kind of, especially if you craft the project so that if there's two possible answers to the experiments and you get answer A, it's very logical, it's very publishable, and you know what to do next. But if you get result B, it's also likely very valuable conclusion, it's publishable, and you know what to do next. So you want to have a project that will give you a high likelihood of getting a solid single. In the hematology world, that means you publish it in the journal Blood or you publish it in, journal Thrombosis and Hemostasis if you're a clotter, or you publish it in Experimental Hematology or something like that. Then you have a second project, which is a much higher risk project, but the payoff is higher. So for me, I'll give a personal example. I was working on a lot of papers on GM-CSF and interleukin-3 and how those genes are transcriptionally regulated and how the structure-function relationships of those proteins work and how those two genes are related to one another. And it was fairly, occasionally had some surprises. And those papers got published in the journal Blood, or they got published in the journal of Biological Chemistry or things like that. But at the same time, for those couple of years, I was working on the cloning of thrombopoietin, a very high-risk project for a couple of reasons. Number one, there were about 12 biotech companies working on it also, and they could easily have scooped me. Fortunately, they didn't. But it was also very unlikely to succeed. I mean, the fact that I took this guess that this
Dr. Koshansky, can you hear me? Can others hear me? I lost Dr. Koshansky.
Yeah, I can hear you, Peter.
Okay. I'll see if he comes back. I still see his... technical difficulties.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what happened, but I sort of restarted it. I'm not sure where I cut off, but I was talking about two kinds of projects, high risk, high payoff, and sort of the solid single project. So if you keep a balanced portfolio like that, you are probably always going to be busy. When one project is clicking on all cylinders, the other one may be sort of dormant for a while as you're developing reagents, or you can be working on both of them simultaneously. But by having the two, you can help yourself, to have both kinds of work. So when it comes time to career assessment, you will have both, hopefully, some high-impact papers. But if not, you still have the solid work that you've been doing. So I don't know that I value one over the other. I've seen examples where people have just gone for home runs all the time, and they've struck out all the time, and their career isn't so wonderful. I've seen the people who don't want to take any risks in their science, and they end up, publishing papers in the Journal of Irreproducible Results all the time, and that isn't really great for the career pathway either. So I would argue both. You do both, keeps you busy. It doubles your likelihood of having very good impacting results, and it sort of hedges your bet a little bit.
Well, thank you. That's a really good way to look at it and to approach our future careers.
Any other final questions?
I'm a little surprised no one asked me. Well, I'm a little surprised nobody asked me why I went over to the dark side and became a department chair or an evil dean. And it's actually a very quick answer. I mentioned the fact that the personal learning curve is very, very useful through that guise. But I also believe that based on people's skill sets, you can make an impact. And I found that the impact one can make by being a mentor is terrific, because you help people develop their career set. But once you become sort of a department chair, by recruiting the right people and putting the right people together, you can launch all sorts of new and innovative science. I think during my career as a department chair, we probably doubled our research productivity at UC San Diego in the Department of Medicine. And then I really do enjoy the impact of all of science. I guess there's a lot of hematologists who don't want to think about anything other than blood. There's a lot of internists who don't want to think about anything other than internal medicine. But I really do enjoy all of medicine and all of the science that's in all of medicine. And so for those reasons, I think that there can be life after being a physician scientist. Although, as Peter mentioned, I still have an R01 grant. I've now been funded, I think, for 30 consecutive years by the NIH. And so that's been fun, but I've got to say, I can see the writing on the wall. At the height of our laboratory's productivity, I think we had 3 R01s, and then I became a department chair, and then I had 2 R01s, and then I'm a dean now, and I have 1 R01, and you can see where that trajectory is leading. But administration can be fun also, because you can make an impact on creating the environment for people like yourselves to come along and launch their careers as physician scientists.
Thank you for the encouragement, sir. Any other final questions? We've just got a few minutes to go. If not, I can ask the final one, and I think I try to ask questions that are relevant to anybody at any stage. So, oh, here's one, Giselle. This can be the final question, then we can, or I might ask one short one after this, but go ahead, sir. Can you read that?
I can. So it says, what skill is worth the effort to develop for our physician scientist career? And I think it's, I don't know that it's a skill, but it's, Joe Goldstein, for those of you, some of you, if you've been to the APSA meeting and the ASCIAP meeting, you've probably heard Joe Goldstein or Mike Brown or both of them speak at that meeting. Mike and Joe, as everyone knows them, Mike and Joe are probably the foremost physician scientists of our time, certainly. They're the people who in 1985 won the Nobel Prize for cracking our understanding of the link between cholesterol and heart disease. Their work sort of was instrumental in getting us to statins, as I sometimes like to say, and they've done even better work since that time. But when Joe was president of the ASCI, Joe wrote a presidential address, and it gets, that's, by the way, one of the only real chores of being president of the ASCI is they make you give a presidential address, and it's published in the JCI. And Joe's thesis was technical courage, that you folks as physician scientists need to develop technical courage. And what did Joe mean by technical courage? So that he gives you an example of a young investigator who learns a new single skill. Say he or she develops an ELISA for an interesting hormone. And but that's all they really did. That's all the laboratory experience they had. They developed this new assay, and they launched their career. And the first paper was an interesting paper. But then their science changed. You know, their field moved over to the left. But they didn't have the courage to reinvent their laboratory skill set because they'd only done this one assay. And so their science went over to the left, and maybe their second paper was a real tiny little paper, and maybe there wasn't a third paper at all. And Joe called this paralyzed academic investigator disease, or PAID. And what Joe argues in that essay, or in that presidential address, is you need to develop technical courage. That is, enough time in the laboratory so that you develop confidence that if your science moves over to the left, you can reinvent the assays that you can perform in the laboratory to pursue that new scientific lead. Or if your research heads over to the right, that you can reinvent because you have the confidence that you can tackle new assays, develop new assays for where your science is heading. And if I had to leave you with the key skill that is worth the effort to develop for being a physician scientist and having a lifelong career with it, it is to develop that technical courage. Don't launch your career really quickly. Gain that experience, gain that confidence, and fill your toolbox, fill your scientific toolbox with a lot of different experiences so that you'll develop that confidence to take your science wherever it may lead you. It's a terrific career, guys. It really is. When I was a full-time physician scientist, I was frequently overheard saying, I can't believe I get paid to do this. And now that I'm a dean, I don't say that so much anymore. But it really is a terrific career pathway, and it's never dull. It is never dull, and it's never predictable. And having that technical courage, having that confidence to go wherever your science takes you is an awful lot of fun, and it's a very productive way to spend your career.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, sir. This has been a very enlightening session, and I think I've enjoyed it. I think everyone who's attending has, and we appreciate you taking time out of your busy day.
Absolutely my pleasure. Now I get to go back to editing William's hematology.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And the next session should be sometime later this month. We're looking at having one with a session with the female physician scientists. So look forward to that, and we'll get this session uploaded online. Have a good night, everybody.